Well, I suppose for most people, it's they don't really think about it very much. It's except maybe the bill. You know, they expect the lights to go on when they turn the light switch, or the your gas heater to go on, or when you get in the car, you turn it on, the engine starts up. But it is fundamental to all our lives, and it's also I suppose from an environmental perspective, where I came from it originally, when I was at university, and then through my career, it is an interest in how we're only on this. We are only on this planet for, well, probably you're probably on this planet for 100 years. You're quite young, and I'm probably on the planet for 90 years. And but obviously our children and grandchildren and things, and how we can maintain our current lifestyles in a way that is actually more sustainable. So it's not about if we don't hair shirts, but it's about thinking about how new technologies and being more responsible can maintain that lifestyle and also give it to more people in the world, but in a way that is it is sustainable. And I've always been very interested in that. So then at the BBC, I did a lot of energy stories, so wind farms and discussions about new nuclear and waste policy. And then came to City Hall, and in due course, the mayor appointed me the environment advisor, and then later the environment and energy advisor, thinking about, from a London perspective, how we can seek to address the trilemma, which is affordability, security, and sustainability of energy systems.
Okay. Well, a few years ago, a lot of young people couldn't take energy for granted, but nowadays, a lot of young people seem to. How do you think this could be addressed in London?
Well, it's quite a difficult question because it's a cultural thing. In that, in the sort of post in the UK at least, in the post-war years, we've seen huge economic growth, a great deal more energy consumption. Our parents and grandparents will remember, coal-fired hearths in their homes, and not having central heating and all these things that we all take for granted. I think there are very few people who don't have central heating now. Whether you could afford to have it whacked up all the time is a different matter, but most people have central heating. So there's been a big cultural change, and people just expect these things to happen. It's quite hard to explain to them that it comes from somewhere and that it needs to be sourced from something. And when you see all the debates and arguments about energy supply and where it should come from in a way that we should, in due course, decarbonize it. And then you hear people saying, but we don't want nuclear, but we don't want this, and other people saying, we don't want wind farms because they're ugly. It's quite difficult to explain what has to come from somewhere. And we can't just dig coal out of the ground anymore because coal is a very polluting fuel. So it's quite a difficult thing to say to people, who are used to it being quite, relatively speaking, cheap, relatively speaking, abundant, to think about it as something that, is a resource that needs to be thought about in the same way that food is, or water, and all these other things.
So, speaking on that subject, do you think in this day and age we can go back to those days where we see the energy being used in terms of, like, for example, back in the day, my grandparents would usually go out and source wood to light a fire to heat up the whole house. Do you think in this day and age we can go back to those?
Well, no, I wouldn't want us to do that. If you want progress, you want to go forward. That sounds like a retrograde step. In that the amount of time and energy spent by your grandparents in going off and chopping down a tree or whatever they did and then burning that tree, which is a pretty, by the way, inefficient fuel and not very good for your health either because of all the pollutants that is in biomass. And I assume they put it in a hearth and just went up the chimney. What we need to do is to explain to people that it's got to come from cleaner sources and what those might be and the energy mix we need. But I don't want people to, like your grandparents did, or my grandparents, all that time and energy spent doing that rather than doing something more productive and to improve their health and well-being and their wealth, frankly.
Do you think the lack of education on energy in our public community causes this conversation in terms of causes them to think that it just comes out from nowhere?
Well, I think in fairness to our education system, I think that kids are taught quite a lot about where the energy comes from. So, sitting in my job as the mayor's environment advisor, and I was saying to one of your colleagues who I was waiting to come in that we get a lot of letters from school kids about climate change issues or air pollution issues or whatever, I think is often perhaps coming up in their school class. So people are taught about sustainability and the fact of we need to move to cleaner fuels, etc. So I think we are taught these things in school, but it's a wider cultural thing to do with what's happened, the fact we've just become more used to warm homes and cheap abundant energy. And I don't want us to go back to cold homes or our grandparents having to go off and dig up trees or whatever, or shovel coal into hearths. But there is that issue to do with thinking about it in that it is a resource in the same way as everything else that you consume is a resource.
Thank you. What do you think could be done to make people more aware of the use of energy within our community?
Well, the obvious thing is putting a horrendous price on it, but that, you know, we don't want to do that because that would be regressive in the way I've already discussed. You don't want people to be living in cold homes. But I think part of it is messaging in schools and then through wider society as well. But explaining it in a way of the opportunities of moving to a sort of low-carbon future. So you find often that the argument is between those people who say, you know, climate change skeptics, who say there isn't a problem, don't worry about it, to those people who say, it's the end of the world as we know it. And there is a way where you can explain this to people, explain the opportunities that it can create. So, you know, here in London alone, the low carbon industries are creating sales of, you know, north of 26, 27 billion quid a year. And that's a lot of money to the London economy and a lot of jobs. So 200,000, 170,000 odd jobs. So there's a lot of people who are employed and are creating new innovative ideas to do all this. And that's the way the conversation should really be about, in my view.
In your views, what is the relationship between energy and the economy?
Oh, it's absolutely vital. I mean, energy is arguably the biggest industry we have because everything is reliant on energy. If you think about the transport sector, what drives those vehicles? Now, it's mainly petrol and diesel, but there's some electric vehicles, all the trains. Many of those run on electricity, some run on diesel. Aeroplanes are all driven by fossil fuels. Equally, you know, how do you build buildings? How do you construct any materials of sitting in this room, this glass of water? A lot of carbon energy went into, you know, cleaning up that glass, making the glass, but then making the water potable and then transporting under pressure to the tap in this building. So everything we do comes from energy system. And except for nuclear, all that energy comes from originally the sun, of course, through fossil fuels or through solar or whatever. So it's the most important driving force for our entire way of life.
In your opinion, do you think it can be a cleaner energy source that we can use in the future?
Well, we're going to need a transition over time. So our entire economic system has been based essentially on fossil fuels. And we need over time, as quickly as we can do, without dislocating the entire economic system that we are based on, to a decarbonised economy. The government has set these targets that by 2050 we should have 80% reductions in carbon emissions. The mayor has set a reduction that by 2025 we should reduce our carbon emissions by 60% from a 1990 base level. Now these are pretty profound changes. When you think about the population increase that London is seeing and the wider UK, the carbon emissions per head have really got to drop a lot while also growing the economy. But we are getting there. We've seen carbon emissions down in London down by 14% since 2008, despite our population going up by approaching a million people. So you can see, and the economy is growing quite a lot as well, so you can see that we can decouple carbon emissions from population and economic growth. So yes, there is a way. And I think London is certainly showing the way, and many other cities and parts of the world are doing so too.
What do you think of the future of fracking in the UK?
The question about fracking is wider to do with energy security. So for the medium term, we're going to need natural gas. So think in London and the UK, 50% of our energy demand is gas for space and water heating. Now, we have lots of policies in London to try and reduce the carbon intensity of that fuel, but it's going to take a while to reduce that. We're also going to need some sort of fuel for baseload energy electricity generation. So we're turning off the coal-fired power plants. It's going to take a while for renewables, because of the intermittency issue, to be the baseload. And then the nuclear will be 10 years away. So we're going to need something for that medium-term transition fuel. We get off coal, which is very polluting, to go to more low-carbon fuel. So there is a big role for natural gas for a long time. You know, for the certainly for the medium term, a generation or so. So the next question is, where do you source that gas from? Do you source that gas from Russia? Well, I would argue very much no, if you see the way they are behaving, when it comes to invading their neighbours, when it comes to turning off the supply or threatening to turn off the supply to their neighbours if you don't behave in a way that Russia wants you to do so. Or do you want it to come from the Gulf, which... is arguably a better place than Russia, but equally is not domestic? Or do you want to source it from the UK? Do you want to source it from domestic sources where we have control of it? And the revenues to that comes to UK businesses and UK taxpayers. And it would seem to me that that question answers itself. So I would say that for the medium term, we're going to need natural gas, and it would best to come from the UK. And if that is from fracking, then that is a better source than from Russia or the Gulf. Well, if you think about, is this question to do with who benefits from their own resources? Is that what you're trying to ask?
No, just the equality and fairness with the trade and with other countries.
Well, we're in a sort of international trading system, which the World Trade Organization runs. I don't quite know what you're trying to ask me. Sorry.
I think he's trying to ask it if would it be a better way to like ensure the cost of energy from different countries less than we're doing now.
Okay, it's interesting as part of the divestment campaign, which the Guardian's obviously been running. I don't know if there's a question of that later on about saying keep all fossil fuels in the ground. That campaign does seem to forget issues to do with some countries, which are still based on what your grandparents sounds like they were doing. Some countries are still like that, or large proportions of populations in some countries are still heating and cooking based on things like wood or coal, or really quite polluting fuels, both for health reasons and also for... Sorry, I bleeped over your mic. And also for carbon intensity. So it would seem to me that surely things like natural gas are better fuel than coal or wood from trees that you chop down close to your house. And there is clearly a role for that in ensuring there is the sort of lifestyle we have, the rest of the world could have in a less environmentally destructive way. I mean, they should learn the lessons from what we've done so that as other countries develop, they can have the warm homes which aren't polluted, the availability of cooked food and all these kinds of things without chopping down the nearest forest, etc. If that answers your question, I'm not sure it does.
Yeah, I think we'll just come back to that question as well. Is wind power really the solution for the future?
Well, it's not the only solution. It's all a mix. We need a mix of energy sources. So we need more distributed energy. At the moment, in the UK at least, we have a number of large power stations supplying electricity to the grid. I think in the future you're going to need more distributed, so you've got lots more small generators in lots of cities especially and all over the place. And wind plays a role in that, but so does solar, so does new nuclear, so does gas for a while. Well, I think nuclear is... I am personally very supportive of nuclear. It gives a reliable base load for the electricity grid and is zero carbon. So it clearly has a very important role in maintaining, in decarbonising our energy system here.
Do you have a favourite in terms of renewable energy?
What?
Power or nuclear?
Well, nuclear isn't officially renewable, but because you're still burning a fuel, it's uranium, which has obviously a lot of. in the world? Well, not really, because we need to have a mix. So renewables has a role, and so definitely does nuclear, but there needs to be a role amongst that. What we don't want to be doing is shoveling lots of coal and eventually gas into our power plants. But it's always worth remembering that 50% of our energy demand in the UK is gas for space and water heating. So people talk about renewables as an electricity generating source, but forgetting that actually half the energy demand is gas for space and water heating. So in London, electricity only meets 30% of energy demand. 20% is fuels for transport, and 50% is fuels for space and water heating. So renewables has a very important role in electricity generation, but it's a much bigger problem than just the electricity that comes out of your plug in the wall. There's also how do you seek to displace gas and petrol and diesel from transport and heating.
Which renewable energy source do you think will be the most cost-effective?
Well, it's very interesting what's happened with the cost of solar. So some of the innovations in China and the scale at which China is investing in renewables has reduced the cost of solar, particularly by a huge amount, very quickly. So much so that it's probably not that far off being deployable at scale without subsidy, which does suggest that there's a real place for solar, even in a place like the UK, which is obviously in Northern Europe, where the sun is not that bright for much of the year, and it's overcast and rains a lot. But there is clearly a large, probably growing role, I think, for solar in the UK. There are obviously political issues around wind, in that onshore has become politically more difficult because of objections to do with unsightliness, and offshore wind needs a lot of subsidy because it's very expensive, because building these things in the sea is not a cheap thing to do. So it would suggest that solar, increasingly, because the cost effectiveness of it becomes very attractive.
What year will London become carbon neutral?
Well, we've set ourselves... Oh, right. The government targets, which hope to meet, which is by 2050, 80%, we have 80% carbon emissions by, from 1990 levels. Oh, sorry, that's a very poorly worded answer. The government has set a target, which we aim to meet, that in 2050 we'll have cut our carbon emissions by 80%, which is, by the way, below pre-industrial levels of carbon emissions, which shows you the scale of challenge we want to get to. And that's no mean feat. But if we can get our carbon emissions below what they were in pre-industrial times, I think that's quite an achievement. So that's what we're working to. We have a piece of work called the London Energy Plan, which we're doing to work out scenarios in which we think we can meet that, mindful of population growth, and what the most cost-effective way, what pathway we should go down in order to meet that 80 by 50 target. Well, that's why we've got the plan, so no. So we're doing the work now. So we know how we can meet our 2020 target through a series of measures which the government should do a bit, we need to do a bit, business needs to do a bit, everybody sort of aggregates up to do the 60% cut by 2025. But to do the 2050 target, right now we don't know, and that's why we're doing the London Energy Plan, to work out what is the most to do the proper analysis on the most cost-effective pathway, spatially across London, to meet that.
What sort of legacy would you like to leave the future generation around energy?
well, I've been very lucky to be asked by the mayor to do this role for him, to lead his team on environment energy policy. And there's a few things that I would certainly like to leave behind, and some of it is actually introducing more of those distributed energy systems. So through a combination of policies, such as planning system and also market measures, so that having more distributed energy generation here in London becomes a better thing to invest in because you get a better return. So using ways so that small generators get a better rate for their electricity than they currently get to the current system. And we are very close to completing our license application to effectively trade electricity between small generators and TfL, which obviously uses a lot of electricity for the tubes and trains, and they will get a better rate for that electricity. So you can see then, as people think through what they want to invest in, what they where should they put these new generators? They put them in London. They get a better rate of return, better investment opportunity to really get those going. And I hope to be able to look back in time and see that it was me that started off or helped start off with the current mayor, that increasing distributed generation here in London, as an example. Another project we have is to do with increasing biodiesel use in London, in our buses, in a way to stimulate the market to have more refining capacity in the southeast and in London. So at the moment, the major biodiesel refining capacity is in the north of the country. So once you haul that down south, you lose a lot of the cost saving, cost benefit, and it doesn't become economically viable to run our bus fleet on. But as soon as you have major refining capacity in the south and southeast of the country, then you lose the haulage cost, and it becomes cost effective. So that I want to see a sort of circular economy in that London's used cooking oil or fats, oils and greases is refined into biodiesel to run our buses or our dumper trucks or our waste vehicles and that kind of thing. And we're quite close to landing that, and I'm quite hopeful that, again, I can look back and think, you know, that my used cooking oil that is now going to fuel the bus, and that was a project that this mayor drove forward. And that's just two examples, I think, of real change, I think, that we have driven through.
Globally, the current process is getting oil and distributing in creating equality and poverty in the world. How might suitable energy affect or change or improve this economy and the world?
Can you repeat the question, please?
Okay, globally, the current process getting oil and distributing and creating equality and poverty in the world. How might sustainable energy affect or change and improve?
Well, there's two questions there. The first one is to do with the fact that in some parts of the world where there has been a lot of oil, and Nigeria is a good example, where they have had huge oil reserves, which they've been exploiting for a long time. And yet, because of poor governance in Nigeria, the people have not benefited in the way they should have done. The billions of pounds, dollars, petrodollars that have been expropriated by corrupt administrations over the decades of oil that has exacerbated a problem. So it's been almost a curse for Nigeria that it's been sitting with oil field. So that's one issue to do with governance in Nigeria and also perhaps some of the behaviour of some of the oil companies as well. And so it should have been a boon for that country. And if you look at where some of the Gulf countries have, like Qatar and Dubai, they have thought through the fact that they're sitting on the sea of oil to make ensure they have an economic basis when oil runs out in however many decades or gas runs out. So that's, I think that's part of the question to do with governance in some countries where there's been oil and ensuring there that the benefits of that huge amount of revenues is actually spread among the people who it belongs to, which is frankly everybody in the country. When it comes to ensuring there is more equality and the fairness in the world, I suppose rather than equality, because you can never really make things equal, but you can give people the opportunities to have a fair go, I suppose. And part of that, I suppose, well, that's a lot more difficult, but that's ensuring a fair trading system, that people get the benefits of what they should get, and of the resources in their country, if you see what I mean. And you know, we in the West, which are obviously very lucky, should be partly helping the governance systems, ensuring it's fair trading. So you do see lots of trade barriers often. So one of the criticisms of the European Union is very inward-looking, and it puts up trade barriers to other countries. And there's, when I was working at the BBC, we did a great story to do with tin tomatoes and the fact that it was cheaper for people, I think it was some country in West Africa, I can't remember, to buy those tin tomatoes from somewhere in Europe because the subsidies the European producers got than from the tin tomato makers in whatever country it was in. And that's a classic example of huge inequalities being really exacerbated by the current trading system, in that we have subsidies to our tin tomato makers here in Europe, destroying the tin tomato makers in a developing country, which just seems completely mad. So you also see European shoppers having to pay more for their own tin tomatoes. So that whole system needs addressing, I think, to ensure equality. You see similar behaviours in North America as well, where you see some protectionism around the United States to protect their indigenous producers rather than allowing other countries, developing countries, to develop that trading system.
or the growing up due to the speed at which we're using it. Some are of the opinion that we should continue using it until it all runs out. Where do you stand on this?
Well, the first thing I would say is I remember when I was at school, which was 30 years ago or so, being told there was only 60 years left of oil. And now, fast forward 30 years, and there's obviously a lot more oil than we were told then. The point is, I suppose, is that we've got technologies to access oil that we couldn't before. So some of the rigs can go 2 miles down and that kind of thing, which they couldn't do back in the 80s. But I don't think we should go and use it all up. No, and that's what my question was about, in that I think that our children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren will be mystified why we put all this oil into our vehicles and into our power plants, and rather than use it for the plastics and into consumer goods, which can be recycled and reused. So plastics can be recycled and reused. Burning something in a petrol engine can't. So it is certainly my view that oil is an astonishing resource, and we could be realistic. We're going to keep burning it for a while, because it's going to take a while to transition away to make sure all our vehicle fleets are all not running on petrol and diesel. But in due course, oil will continue to be extracted from the earth. There's a lot of it still around, but it should be used for those sorts of, for computers, for building materials, for plastics, for this chair I'm sitting on, for the clothes I'm wearing, for fertilizers. Our fertilizers are oil-based, by the way. And that's what they should be used. It should be used for. It is madness to burn it. But we are. It's going to take a while to transition away from that, but I certainly don't think we should just burn it up in the atmosphere. What we shouldn't be doing is sticking into a CO2 in the atmosphere. It should be going into consumer goods and products and things to make our lives better.
So you're fully, fully supporting electric-generated cars?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, we've been doing all we can here in London to go to more ultra-low emission vehicles, be that hydrogen, which is hydrogen fuel cell, or be that electric, or whatever other technologies there might be. As the grid is decarbonised, clearly there is a huge role for electric vehicles, and also amazing air pollution benefits in that they have zero tailpipe emissions. So London has an air pollution problem. So clearly reducing the amounts of emissions from vehicles is the main way we can do to get on top of it.
Do you have an electric car yourself?
No.
What policies would you like to see to put in place to reduce the fuel poverty in the UK? For example, do you think that housing insulation is important, and how can you help people to make these solutions?
Well, the UK, this is hard to believe, has some of the lowest energy prices per unit in Western Europe. But because of our buildings are some of the leakiest in the world, leakiest in Europe, not necessarily the world, leakiest in Europe, most energy inefficient, our energy bills are stubbornly high. So it is of vital importance that we retrofit, put the insulation, our older buildings. We're not going to go and level all those, I live in a Victorian house, all those Victorian houses. We're not going to. We like them. They're quite pretty, they're nicely built, they're good families, all the rest of it. So we're not going to knock them down and build some energy-efficient housing. But clearly, my house is windy and it's drafty and it's quite cold in the winter and it's not cheap to heat, that there is a big job for us to retrofit our buildings, because 80% of them will still be with us in 50 years' time, to make them energy-efficient, to reduce fuel poverty. Because in the longer term, energy bills are only ever going to rise. So we're going to need to consume less to address fuel poverty and make sure people don't live in cold, drafty homes. So it is very important that we have a big programme of retrofit. And London has continuously not done very well out of the government pot of retrofitting for complicated reasons to it being more expensive in London and all these other things. And our housing stock is more challenging because it's mainly those Victorian solid wall buildings. But it's very, very important, and the mayor has said repeatedly we need a huge program to install energy efficiency measures in London buildings.
Why don't more building projects, housing and industries deliver even better energy solutions?
Sorry, could you repeat the question?
Sorry. Why don't more building projects, housing and industry deliver even better energy solutions?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure that's a fair question, because I would say that, in fact, the planning policy that the mayor has put in, the London plan, which the boroughs have to adapt, have some very stringent energy standards, in fact. So we were demanding 40% above the Part L 2010 planning policy building guidance, which in a more technical way, we were demanding extremely tight energy standards. So that we were, meaning that we were, A, the buildings were being lean and green, so they were using not much energy, but they were also contributing energy generation infrastructure to London. So that might be heating networks in order to provide low carbon electricity, power and heat generation. So I would say actually in fairness, the planning system and new buildings is the best way and the easiest way to introduce the most sustainable infrastructure and also to deliver some of those distributed energy systems that I referred to earlier. How many more have we got?
A few.
Okay, a few.
Yeah.
Okay.
Less than 10.
Less than fewer than 10. All right. Okay.
What should be done to encourage more renewable energy in new buildings and domestic and commercial?
Renewable systems in that's quite a difficult question to ask. Renewable energy in London buildings is not always the easiest thing to do, because there's obviously no space for wind in that. It's a tight urban centre, and you need space and hills and things to have wind generation. Solar PV, there is a real opportunity, and we are looking at what barriers there are in order to overcome them and to deliver that at the scale, because as the price of solar comes down, the opportunities clearly go up, and it doesn't need subsidy particularly. It is a very exciting time, I think, for solar. But there are things in planning policies which are quite strong on this. You need to ensure that the feed-in tariff is at a decent rate. But you need to be careful that it's not over-subsidised. So there's a point back in 2011, I think, when the government changed the feed-in tariffs, that it was effectively over-subsidised. And that subsidy is paid for people's fuel bills. So you need a balance between ensuring it's affordable, but you're also delivering out at scale. So that's where the difficulty of government policy always is where should that line be? And if you saw in the last general election where energy pricing became a big hot political potato, and some of that is because of the cross-subsidies there are in low-carbon generation, which we need, but you've got to be mindful of the impact on fuel poverty and the other issues. So you know, there's this constant tension. This is where politicians need to make those decisions in order to make almost the compromises between one and the other. And you know, it's always weighing up the different priorities there are in government policy.
Reliable energy source do you think would be most cost effective?
I think there is clearly an opportunity for solar in due course as the costs come down. I think that it's interesting that in France, by the way, which has the lowest power prices in Europe, their power nearly all comes from nuclear. And I think that if this country got a new nuclear program going so that we had a design of reactor that we were competent in, and you know, once you build more of these things, the economy of scale, you force the price down. Certainly when it comes to the reliable baseload of power, I think nuclear has a very, very big role. But actually, we need a mix of renewables and new nuclear. You can't really say there's one solution. There is not a silver bullet to this problem, because if there were, we would be doing it. It's a complicated mix, energy mix of solutions. It's hard to point out one particular one and say, I think that's the most cost effective, because they're all part of the solution.
You see that as the solution for London in the future?
Well, I don't think we're not going to have nuclear reactors in London, clearly, but we are connected to the national grid, so we'll still be having quite a lot of power coming from power stations outside of London.
How far away do you think we are from London being entirely powered by renewable energy?
Well, I don't think we're ever going to be completely powered by renewable energy, because new nuclear is not officially classed as renewable. So, and I think new nuclear will play a very large role in a low carbon future. So, to be honest, I don't think we'll ever reach renewable. When it gets to zero carbon electricity, well, it's some way off, because we're going to need to build some of these new reactors. That's at least a decade away. So we're talking about a generational shift. It'll take to 2050, I would say, hopefully not as fast as 2050, but it's going to take a generation to decarbonise our grid.
What would be your energy strategy?
Well, I think all of my previous questions kind of answer that. I think, to be honest.
Sorry.
Well, we have targets here in London that 25% of London's buildings' energy demand should be met from local generation. So I think that's quite important in an urban context, to where we have tightly developed buildings, where we're living, you know, a lot of us are living in quite small spaces, and you also have mixed land use, so you have some housing, you've got universities, education establishments, you've got light industrial, you've got commercial, you have that buildings mix, that you can have these heat networks where you have an energy centre which is creating heat and power, and the power goes to heat, in a heat network, so you all connect up with hot water pipes to do space and water heating. And that has a very important role in helping to decarbonise our energy system. But it's all part of this sort of greater mix, and I think we need to transition as quickly as we reasonably can from fossil fuels, but it's going to take a generation, as I said earlier. You can refer to my earlier answers,
yeah.
I would say.
And last question.
I'm optimistic about it. I think you hear quite often too much doom and gloom about the decarbonisation and the fact that there's an element of lecturing or preaching to people, which turns most people off, or want to wear a hair shirt and feel guilty. I think that the opportunities there is to decarbonise, which I think we have to do, are extremely positive. The economic opportunities there are. We have cut our carbon emissions in London by 14% since 2008, despite our population going up by 1 million, and despite the recession, astonishingly robust economic growth. Urban centres around the world, not just London, but I represent London, so I'm going to big us up, have really shown the world what can be done, how we can create a better quality of life for our residents, how we can alleviate fuel poverty, which you talked about, how we can alleviate air pollution, which I've talked about, how we can create jobs and growth, give people better lives, wealthier lives, healthier lives. And I think thinking about this Paris Climate Summit in the end of the year, where national governments will hopefully come to some kind of agreement, cities such as London, such as Paris, such as Johannesburg, such as New York, really are showing how we can do this, how we can... And that is obviously all in Chinese cities. And that is across the economic spectrum, from developing countries to advanced Western economies. How we can seek to give our residents that better quality of life and make them healthier and wealthier and reduce our carbon emissions. And I'm quite optimistic about it. And I think that talking about the downsides is not going to engage and excite most people. Most people, as we said at the very beginning, don't really think about energy very much. And that's why saying doom and gloom isn't going to really speak to them. But if you talk about the opportunities there is, about how it's going to have cleaner, healthier, better lives, it will engage people and they will take interest and they will do the small things that we need to do that transition.